fighting, he complained bitterly of the many months the Army of the Potomac, under the command of General George B. McClellan, lay idle around Washington, D.C. 6 months of reading every morning that it was all quiet on the Potomac was enough, said the angry editor, to exhaust the patience of Job. Douglas vigorously protested against McClellan's dismissal of the Hutchinson family singers from his camps for singing abolitionist songs. Douglas expressed defeatism in February 1862. The stand-still, do-nothing policy of Lincoln's government led Douglas to accuse the administration and its military team of treason or utter incompetency. Only a robust effort to defeat slaveholders, he believed, could prevent the rebels from winning their independence once the armies moved in the spring. Douglas delivered two major speeches that winter, one in Philadelphia in January, and the other a month later in Boston. Both laid out his apocalyptic vision of the war. In both speeches, as well as many editorials in the first half of 1862, Douglas asserted the case for black loyalty, for the recruitment of black troops, as he also vigorously denounced all colonization schemes emerging from the Lincoln administration. Exasperated by the slow pace of the war, Douglas offered many ideas about how to make the bloodletting meaningful and holy. "I am to speak to you tonight of the Civil War," Douglas announced to his Philadelphia audience in National Hall, "by which this vast country, this continent, is convulsed. Nations, like individuals," the orator maintained, "receive divine warnings that they must either heed or face destruction. Americans were being taught in this war as with the emphasis of an earthquake. Their warning arrived not in comets blazing through the troubled sky, but in the terrible calamity of a widespread rebellion enacted before our eyes." Douglas spoke glowingly at first of the American Republic as a young nation, giving it personal qualities, great in mental, moral, and physical resources. But any nation, like a person, must suffer, fall, and reform. Drawing on Hamlet's lament, Douglas observed that the face of every loyal citizen is sicklied over with the pale cast of thought. Every pillar in the national temple is shaken. The nation itself has fallen asunder in the center. Douglas himself pulled with all his might now to make those pillars fall. Slavery's poisoning of the national character, he contended, threatened destruction more than the Confederate armies. Lacing his narrative with scripture, Douglas proclaimed, "We have faithfully copied all the cunning of the serpent without any of the harmlessness of the dove or the boldness of the lion." Drawing deep from his favorite well, Douglas observed, "It would seem in the language of Isaiah that the whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint, that there is no soundness in it." With the old prophets as guides, Douglas watched the American temple destroyed so that it might be reinvented. Glimmers of hope emerged from the Congress and the White House that spring. But first, Douglas had to make the argument for why this was a black Americans' war. In 1862, Douglas proffered a wide-ranging discussion of the loyalty of his people. He made effective use of the idea of black loyalty, whether speaking in his role as an abolitionist or that of a war propagandist. "I believe up to this time," Douglas said in February, "no man has been able to cast a shadow of a doubt upon the loyalty and patriotism of the free colored people in this the hour of the nation's trial and danger." But he was bitter that the federal government had spurned the service of black loyalists. "The Washington government wants men for its army, but thus far it has not had the boldness to recognize the manhood of the race to which I belong." The order wanted black patriotism acknowledged in all its forms. Douglas believed American history and character were essentially the embodiment of contradiction. "He is the best friend of this country," said Douglas in early 1862, "who at this tremendous crisis dares tell his countrymen the truth, however disagreeable that truth may be. And such a friend I will aim to be. He had taken such a position on patriotism since his days as a Garrisonian. I will hold up America to the lightning scorn of moral indignation, he said in an 1847 speech. In doing this, I shall feel myself discharging the duty of a true patriot, for he is the lover of his country, who rebukes and does not excuse its sins. Douglass could be included among those Americans the modern theologian Donald W. Shriver, Jr. has called honest patriots, those who manifest an ironic, tragic love of country by learning, narrating, and working through its past of contradiction and evil, and not by evading it. Upon this philosophical basis, Douglass built his case for black patriotism as well as for revolutionary change. He had more confidence in Southern villainy than in Northern virtue. He believed the Union side had two classes of loyalists. The two talk alike, he told his Boston audience in February, but one class is for putting down the rebellion by force and force alone, and without abolishing slavery, and the other is for putting down the rebellion by putting down slavery on every rod of earth which shall be made sacred by the footprints of a single loyal soldier. One class would strike down the effect, the other would strike at the cause. Unmistakably, Douglass equated true loyalty and patriotism with abolitionism, an ironic, if vexing, notion among a white population that increasingly believed slavery had to be killed of necessity to win the war. Douglass constantly professed his own loyalty. I allow no man to exceed me in the desire for the safety and welfare of this country, he pronounced in Boston. He called the Union the shield protecting Americans from treason, rebellion, and anarchy. He asserted his sense of birthright. I am an American citizen, in birth, in sentiment, in ideas, in hopes, in aspirations and responsibilities. I am an American citizen. Then he stated the collective case for free blacks, linking loyalty with military service. Blacks had demonstrated the most ardent desire to serve the cause, only to be met with rejection at recruiting stations. Colored men were good enough to fight under Washington, Douglass wrote. They are not good enough to fight under McClellan. Against all odds, Douglass staked his case on the loyalty of potential black soldiers. But Douglass was equally fond of demonstrating the perseverance of loyalty among black civilians. The Negro is the veritable Mark Tapley of this country, he wrote in July, referring to the amiable character in Charles Dickens' savagely comic Martin Chuzzlewit. That most obliging, good-tempered character was not more determined to be jolly under severely unfavorable circumstances than the Negro is to come out strong in patriotism under every possible discouragement. Douglass's reference to Dickens's Mark Tapley is particularly intriguing. It reflects more than his affinity for Dickens. Tapley is the jolly but serious voice of the downtrodden, as well as a critic of his own country's hypocrisies and faults, especially slavery. For Douglass, who himself became a master of sarcasm and irony in the face of the absurdity of slavery and racism, Dickens was a vivid model. Martin Chuzzlewit is Dickens's novel written after his disappointing visit to the United States in 1843, in which he spared America none of its pretensions and evils, especially the lies at the root of slaveholding. It is the jovial Tapley who captures the meaning of the selling of the daughter of an elderly black man named Cicero. Lord, love you, sir. They're so fond of liberty in this part of the globe that they buy her and sell her and carry her to market with them. They've such a passion for liberty that they can't help taking liberties with her. Bitingly, Tapley cries, Liberty forever! Hurrah! Hail Columbia! 10 years before emancipation, a Dickens-inspired attitude toward absurdity may have fueled Douglass's famous call in his greatest speech for scorching irony, biting ridicule, and withering sarcasm, after asking, Would you have me argue that man is entitled to liberty? Loyalty and patriotism are tortured concepts in time of war. For Douglass, in 1862-63, loyalty was both an aspiration and a pragmatic device for the war propagandist. A yearning to belong might yet be combined with the right to fight in a cause blacks could view as their own. From the beginning of the war, Abraham Lincoln faced the increasingly dominant question of slavery. The Republican-controlled Congress began to act with, and sometimes before, the president in 1862. Lincoln had always hated slavery and wished it somehow destroyed, but he was very much a constitutionalist, working within what he viewed as the restraints of his legal power as commander-in-chief. Moreover, Lincoln had always been a Henry Clay Whig. His instinctive and ideological approach to slavery's ultimate demise derived from three ideas: that emancipation ought to be gradual, compensated, and ultimately result in the colonization of as many blacks as possible outside the United States. Lincoln's temperament, as well as this set of deeply honed political instincts, racial views, and strategies, collided head-on in historic proportions with increasingly all-out war. Lincoln began to think constantly about slavery by early 1862, and in March he began to act. Until then, Lincoln's approach to slavery had emerged as an assortment of floating ideas and incoherent policies. But he possessed a remarkable capacity to adapt, grow, and change on this most crucial question. On March 6th, the president sent a message to Congress recommending that it authorize funding for gradual and compensated emancipation for the border slave states still in the Union. He stressed that this would merely be an initiation of a gradual and not sudden process, and stated that he would not threaten slave property within state limits, meaning in the Confederacy. The message was subject to the free choice of those northernmost border states, who might, if they accept it, send a signal to the seceded states to the south that they would never join them. In unveiled language, Lincoln declared it impossible to foresee what further consequences the war would bring for slavery and the South if it continued. Abolitionists responded with surprise and enthusiasm to Lincoln's message. Wendell Phillips called it unexpected as a thunderbolt in a clear sky. And Douglas breathed a new tone. "It is really wonderful," he said by April 1862, "how all efforts to evade, postpone, and prevent its emancipation coming have been mocked and defied by the stupendous sweep of events." Douglas rejoiced that he had lived to see the President of the United States deliberately advocating emancipation. Above all, Douglas captured the future irony of Lincoln's move. "Time and practice will improve the President as they improve other men. He is tall and strong, but he is not done growing. He grows as the nation grows." In a flourish of hope in a Rochester speech, Douglas warmed up to Lincoln for the moment. The president was now an honest patriot endeavoring to save his country in its day of peril. The March message, however nuanced, fell as the brick knocked down at the end of the row by which the whole line is prostrate. Lincoln tried assiduously to convince border state congressmen and special delegations to accept his offer of gradual compensated emancipation, but to no avail. Maryland, Kentucky, Missouri, and even Delaware, with its small number of slaves, officially resisted abolition. The most telling response Lincoln and his administration received to these overtures was that virtually all border state officials strongly supported colonization. If the war, by its force and logic, did cause the liberation of some slaves, border politicians wanted the government to provide for removal of free blacks from the country. A huge fight on that issue loomed on the immediate horizon, as in April, another brick was about to fall. From mid-March to early April, Congress fiercely debated a measure to emancipate the 3,200 slaves in the District of Columbia, where the federal government held jurisdiction. The roiling debate in both houses centered on the capacities of black people to cope with freedom, and what was to be done with them after emancipation. In the end, all Republicans voted for the bill, and all but 4 Northern Democrats voted against it, a prelude to many further fights to come. The measure provided $300 per slave in compensation to slaveholders, as well as $100,000 for schemes of colonization in the wake of abolition in the district. After much consternation, Lincoln signed the bill on April 16th. Douglas rejoiced, although he hated the colonization provisions in the Emancipation Bill. Even before passage, he wrote to Charles Sumner, who had gained close access to the president, thanking him for his efforts. "I trust I am not dreaming," Douglas said, "but the events taking place seem like a dream." As each brick in a row fell, some more easily than others, Douglas measured progress as he tempered his own emotions. The federal treasury paid out approximately $900,000 to slaveholders in the district, who lined up to receive their checks. To assess the value of slaves, the government employed a Baltimore slave trader for advice. Despite all these acknowledgments of slaves as property and the white supremacy expressed in so much of the legislative debate, for the first time in history, a federal statute gave freedom to slaves. In June, in yet another thoroughly partisan enactment, Congress ended slavery in all Western territories. Few slaves actually lived there, but the measure possessed great symbolic significance, given the issue's centrality to so much of American political history. Finally, by July, after protracted, embittered debate over unprecedented constitutional questions about the authority to liberate slaves or employ black soldiers, Congress passed and then Lincoln signed the Second Confiscation Act. On July 12th, Lincoln made one last-ditch effort to persuade a large delegation of border state representatives to initiate gradual, compensated emancipation in their states. The president lectured the delegates gathered at the White House, arguing that the war would in time erode and eliminate slavery by mere friction and abrasion. But the border representatives' steadfast rejections once again pushed Lincoln to more radical action. For many months, pressure had precipitously risen for action against slavery as a military necessity, a phrase used widely all over the North. Douglas applauded this change in Northern sentiment. "Tens of thousands were now having the scales torn from their eyes," he said. "The result will be nearly the same to the slave. If from motives of necessity or any other motives, the nation shall be led to the extinction of slavery." Attacking slavery became increasingly popular to large numbers of Northerners as a means of defeating the Confederacy. Lincoln's conception of his war powers changed as he faced the potential of General McClellan's colossal defeat in the Peninsula Campaign in Virginia. The general's ambitious plan to take Richmond from the east ended disastrously at the Battle of the Seven Days in late June and early July. Lincoln faced a Confederate invasion of northern soil by midsummer 1862. The war had escalated into a bloody multi-front crusade on both sides. The pillars of the temple were falling, as Douglas wished, but the Union cause required revolutionary measures in order to win. The Confiscation Act was just such a measure. It freed all slaves of disloyal owners in Confederate territory occupied by Union forces, as well as any slaves escaping to Union lines. The law further authorized the president to employ blacks as he deemed necessary and proper for the suppression of the rebellion. It also suggested that as many blacks as were willing should be colonized in some tropical country. Fraught with contradiction, the Second Confiscation Act nevertheless meant, as the anti-slavery Springfield Republican put it, that every victory by Union forces is a victory for emancipation. Douglas worried as he watched and alternately cheered or denounced this historic process. In March 1862, he reported on a lecture tour just completed of more than 1,000 miles, speaking to tens of thousands of people through many towns in the states of Massachusetts, New York, and New Jersey. He described himself as encouraged by his audiences and by conversations along the way. "The popular ear is open, and the popular heart is everywhere sensitive to impression," he announced. The same month, Douglas wrote a long piece, The Situation of the War, in which he listed every military engagement in the first year of the war, celebrated the recent Union victories at Forts Henry and Donelson in Tennessee, and prematurely declared, "Failure plainly written on the rebellion as a military power. Douglas did not yet fully grasp military campaigns, their logistics and results on the ground, thus leading him to rash statements sometimes laced with confused political sentiments. He accurately predicted worse fighting to come as spring offensives commenced. He still feared political compromise with slavery that might yet arise from the Lincoln administration, as well as weak and treacherous magnanimity on the part of some Union generals who refused to fight a relentless war. In awkwardly chosen words, Douglas wrote, "The North has been angry with the South only as a child is angry with a pet, and that anger soon passes away when the pet has been well kicked." After the horrifyingly bloody Battle of Shiloh in southwest Tennessee on April 6th to 7th, with its 20,000 killed and wounded on both sides, he needed more chastened and graceful language to describe the Union war effort. As the bloody summer of 1862 dragged on, Douglas followed every development from Rochester and from the Speaker's circuit. He was at first thrilled with the Second Confiscation Act, reprinting its primary emancipation provisions, but then he declared it significant or insignificant only as the president himself shall determine. He also reprinted in full Lincoln's formal exchange from July with the border state congressman. Douglas's heart sank as he read the president's forthright final appeal for gradual and compensated abolition in the four states, to be followed by some degree of black removal. Such an appeal was especially unnerving, given the historical precedent of Indian removal accomplished a quarter century earlier. "How much better to do it while we can," Lincoln had said, "lest the war ere long render us pecuniarily unable to do it. How much better for you as seller, and the nation as buyer, to sell out and buy out that without which the war could never have been, than to sink both the thing to be sold and the price of it in cutting one another's throats." After this business advice about how and when to profit from their slaves, Lincoln appealed to the one issue that would animate and anger Douglas the most. "Room in South America for colonization can be obtained cheaply and in abundance," the chief executive lectured his recalcitrant guests, "and when numbers shall be large enough, the freed people will not be so reluctant to go." Douglas would soon be lecturing the president about just how much he should presume to know the intentions and spirits of black people for leaving their own country to satisfy the demands of white supremacy. On June 18, 1862, Julia Crofts wrote to Douglas from London, parroting back some striking sentiments she had just read in her old friend's voice in the current issue of his paper. "Oh, why will the government trumpet give an uncertain sound?" Overcome by tears after hearing for the first time the singing of the John Brown song in England, she wished that the next 4th of July, in her former co-editor's words, might witness a glorious declaration of liberty to the captive and the opening of the prison to them that are bound. By the time Douglas printed that letter, he had indeed crafted another major 4th of July address. Early on the morning of July 4th, Douglas took the Elmira and Canandaigua Railroad from Rochester, southeast approximately 60 miles, to a tiny town called Himrod's Corners, New York. Arriving at the sleepy village located between Keuka and Seneca Lakes, some 8 miles south of Penn Yan, Douglas stepped off the cars and found no one to receive him. So he simply started walking until he encountered someone who could take him to his hosts. Soon, this little settlement of 2 taverns, 1 church, 6 neat little cottages, 1 store, and a pile of sawed wood began to transform for celebration. By late morning, Douglas saw the star-spangled banner flying from many a Liberty pole, and before long, by rail and in farm wagons, a throng estimated at 2,000 arrived and assembled in a grove of noble pines under a bright blue sky. They had not gathered, said their orator, for fun and frolic, not for mirth or senseless parade, but to listen to Douglas consider the perilous condition of the country. Under a canopy of trees, to a throng of Western New York and Finger Lakes region farmers and townspeople, many of whom had sons, brothers, or fathers in the army in Virginia, Douglas delivered a carefully prepared address he called the Slaveholders' Rebellion. Most of his arguments had been well rehearsed in editorials and speeches that spring and summer. With reports of the shocking bloodshed all around the eastern perimeter of Richmond and the retreat of McClellan's army to the James River in defeat just trickling in, Douglas acknowledged a midnight blackness intruding on their beautiful day. The country was undergoing a social earthquake. The National House was on fire. Douglas addressed big subjects: the origin of the war, its taproot and its sap, its trunk and its branches, all born of slavery; the Confederacy's quest to forge in revolution an eternal slaveholders' republic; a history of the litany of compromises with slavery over time; the many perversions of the Declaration of Independence in the service of satisfying the demands of the slave power; the inevitability of the war, and McClellan's alleged disastrous incompetence, as well as the duplicity within the Lincoln administration. The war had now reached such scale of bloodshed that it was no longer about constitutional authority, but about which side had the will to fight to win. In this sobering critique of the Union war effort, one new and important element emerged. In the shade of a beautiful grove, the floor of the natural arena strewn with pine needles, Douglas's deep baritone called out an honest abolitionist's patriotism. Contrary to his magnificent Jeremiad for the 4th of July in 1852, where the orator rang down a hailstorm separating himself and your fathers, your Declaration of Independence, and your 4th of July, this time at Himrod's Corners, 10 years later, and in the midst of a war that now showed vivid signs of becoming a struggle against slavery, Douglas suddenly altered the pronouns. The claims of our fathers upon our memory, admiration, and gratitude are founded in the fact that they wisely and bravely and successfully met the crisis of their day. This time he took ownership in the special day and gave it new meaning. If the men of this generation would deserve well of posterity, they must, like their fathers, discharge the duties and responsibilities of their age. It was now his age, his duty, and especially his country. They had gathered this time, said the Black Jeremiah in softer tones, to draw a new meaning around the birth of our national independence. Douglas linked past to present as he instructed the throng sitting on wagons and leaning on trees. We are only continuing the tremendous struggle which your fathers and my fathers began 86 years ago. Douglas had never before called the American founders his fathers. For him, a second American Revolution was underway, more bloody, but perhaps more enduring and important than the first. He claimed his place among the founders of the Second Republic. For Douglas, emotionally and ideologically, the remainder of 1862 was as turbulent as any period in his life. The path to emancipation, despite the triumphal meanings we retrospectively give it, was never linear or certain. Douglas now witnessed and interpreted the greatest changes as well as some of the most discouraging challenges he ever faced. At stake were the character and the future of Black freedom. Douglas plowed every ounce of his millennial and apocalyptic sensibility into his vision of events. Keeping faith in the Jubilee to come out of this epic struggle required a belief that God could enter human affairs, that history could undergo sudden and radical change. The escalating war, however dark, made such a faith fathomable. Douglas frequently used such terms as the laws of God or laws of nature to describe the engines of history. The world, he announced in an early 1863 speech, like fish preached to in the stream, moves on in obedience to the laws of its being, bearing away all excrescences and imperfections in its progress. It has its periods of illumination as well as of darkness, and often bounds forward a greater distance in a single year than in an age before. With this apocalyptic mentality, Douglas watched, lived, and interpreted the history enveloping him. In September 1862, in the wake of the terrible Union defeat at Second Manassas in late August, and as Robert E. Lee's Confederate Army invaded Maryland in the most threatening moment of the war to date, Douglas called for stern, vigorous, unrelenting war with rebels. Divine messages lay in sufferings, disasters, defeats, in language strikingly similar to that used by Julia Ward Howe in her Battle Hymn of the Republic, first published as lyrics earlier that year in the Atlantic Monthly. Douglas measured progress now in blood. "A fiery sword of justice waved over the land," Douglas wrote. "We are to be saved as by fire." His message was about a brutal chastening from a vengeful God. He acknowledged the need to grieve with the sorrow-stricken families all over the North. But their terrible afflictions and heavy sorrows are their educators. With this harsh outlook, the steely-eyed editor confronted as well the most frustrating issue of all, colonization. Colonization had deep and complex origins in the early American Republic. What some historians call the phase of benevolent colonization, especially from roughly 1816 to the 1840s, stemmed from a complicated set of motives on the part of some white Americans. They advocated emigration as an ancient right of peoples to seek new beginnings so that blacks, like other migrants, could develop their own independent societies unburdened by white racism, in a quest for equality apart from a stronger or dominant race, and as an abiding part of the biblical Exodus narrative. The story of Exodus has long driven the attraction of emigration schemes, especially in times of crisis among black Americans. But for Douglas, colonization was an old and agonizing question. With only some exceptions, some plans led by blacks themselves aimed at staying in the Western Hemisphere, he had always hated the premises of colonization. He did honor and report about Martin Delaney's journeys during the war to West Africa in search of sites for colonies. Douglas gave qualified endorsement to the spirit of Delaney's quest, if not to his theories about racial purity, his hyperbole about finding a land of the pure black uncorrupted by Caucasian blood. As early as 1849, Douglas had warned against slaveholding charmers in any guise, who had always conjured up their old familiar spirits of colonization. He despised its aims, as he said in 1856, because of its capacity to confirm existing prejudice as a thing natural and unsurmountable. Douglas always saw colonization as a debate over human dignity, not over improving race relations by separating blacks from whites. He never viewed it merely as a policy or a strategy. However well-intentioned or packaged in liberal aims, it was removal, never reform. By wartime, as the Lincoln administration launched various schemes of colonization, Douglas called it the bugbear that has so troubled the American people and the singularly pleasing dream of white supremacists. Lincoln, a longtime sympathizer with colonization, set in motion a multi-layered effort to expatriate blacks from the country. As early as March 1861, Lincoln had instructed Elisha Oscar Crosby, the newly appointed minister resident to Guatemala, to seek a place for black colonists in Central America. Crosby organized his mission throughout 1861, despite opposition from both the Guatemalan and Honduran governments. An ill-fated colonization scheme in Panama also emerged in the first year of the war. From April to August 1862, Lincoln received a great deal of advice regarding colonization. The president's cabinet remained quite divided on the issue, while strong support still existed in many quarters of the administration and Congress for sending freed blacks to the nation of Liberia in West Africa. For a while, Lincoln also entertained a scheme that would have sent 10,000 black troops into Florida to defeat Confederates, thereby seizing back the state for the Union and forming the basis of a large migration to reconstruct that state. Serious interest in black emigration also took hold in Brazil, the British West Indies, and the Danish island of St. Croix. By the end of August 1862, agents from several West Indian colonies were on their way to Washington. But due to the delicate diplomatic relationship between the United States and Britain, as well as American abolitionist resistance, the West Indian initiatives never came to fruition. At this critical juncture, Lincoln decided on August 14th to meet with a small delegation of black ministers at the White House to discuss colonization. This infamous meeting, Lincoln's worst racial moment, was anything but a discussion. A nearly desperate president gave a one-way lecture looking for self-sacrificing black men to volunteer to leave their country to assuage the fears of white people who now had to imagine the end of slavery. The delegation, all from the Washington, D.C. area, was led by Edward M. Thomas, president of an organization called the Anglo-African Institute for the Encouragement of Industry and Art. This hastily assembled meeting did not include the more prominent Douglas, nor even the black emigrationists, the Reverend Henry Highland Garnett or Martin Delaney. After shaking hands with his guests at this first ever meeting of a president with black leaders, and with one or more members of the press invited to listen and record, Lincoln read a formal statement to the stunned ministers. Lincoln could not have been more forthright. "You and we are different races. We have between us a broader difference than exists between almost any other two races. Whether it is right or wrong, I need not discuss, but this physical difference is a great disadvantage to us both. Blacks and whites mutually suffer from each other's presence in the same land," argued the president. "For this reason," Lincoln concluded, "we should be separated." Lincoln shockingly blamed the war on the presence of blacks. "But for your race among us, there could not be war. Although many men engaged on either side do not care for you one way or another." The host acknowledged that blacks, slave or free, were enduring the greatest wrong inflicted on any people, but racial equality of any kind, in his view, could never be possible in America. "On this broad continent," said Lincoln, "not a single man of your race is made the equal of a single man of ours." He did not wish to debate this inequality, since it was a fact about which we all feel and think alike, I and you. With one astonishing presumption after another, he argued that slavery had evil effects on the white race as well. "See our present condition, the country engaged in war, our white men cutting one another's throats." Lincoln beseeched the five black representatives, who must have felt more than a little bewildered, to swallow their wishes for a future in the land of their birth and lead their people to a foreign colony. He did not wish to seem unkind, but for them to reject his plea to lead in voluntary repatriation would be an extremely selfish view of the case and not in the best interest of their race. "It is exceedingly important that we have men at the beginning capable of thinking as white men," he bluntly continued, "and not those who have been systematically oppressed." Did the president really invite these men to the executive mansion to insult them? Perhaps not. But in conceiving the audience as the wider nation, he surely understood whose prejudices he stoked and at whose expense. Lincoln concluded by putting the best possible face on Central America as the site of his colonization project. He employed the old racist canard that blacks could thrive in a similarity of climate with your native land. He promoted the prospect of employment in the coal mines. He suggested, against his own diplomatic intelligence, that the countries of Central America would warmly welcome them, and as president, he pledged personally that he would endeavor to have you made equals. He wanted 100 to start the colony, but almost like an auctioneer, he said he would take 50 or even 25 able-bodied men with a mixture of women and children to make a successful commencement. This wretched encounter ended with Edward Thomas saying they would get back to Lincoln with an answer. As before and after, this discussion of colonization turned on two fundamentally different conceptions of the future of black Americans. To Lincoln, a biracial democracy in America would never be possible. Most black leaders, however, were flushed with new hopes about a future precisely opposite from that outlined in Lincoln's appeal. Douglas was outraged at Lincoln's address to the black delegation. In September, he reprinted Lincoln's remarks in full in his paper, then penned the harshest criticism he ever leveled at the president. "Mr. Lincoln assumes the language and arguments of an itinerant colonization lecturer, charged Douglas, showing all his inconsistencies, his pride of race and blood, his contempt for Negroes, and his canting hypocrisy. How an honest man could creep into such a character as that implied by this address, we are not required to show. The editor lambasted Lincoln's claim that the mere presence of blacks had caused the war. Dissolving his anger in sarcasm, Douglas likened Lincoln's logic to a horse thief pleading that the existence of the horse is the apology for his theft, or a highwayman contending that the money in the traveler's pocket is the sole first cause of his robbery. In this tragic humor, Douglas did Lincoln, the famous storyteller, one better. The war, contended Douglas, emerged from the cruel and brutal cupidity of those who wish to possess horses, money, and Negroes by means of theft, robbery, and rebellion. Douglas slammed Lincoln's affirmation of white supremacy, calling him a genuine representative of American prejudice and Negro hatred. Douglas had no interest in acknowledging Lincoln's need to assuage white fears or to appeal to border state sensitivities. Douglas felt betrayed by Lincoln's stark appeal to blacks to leave the country for white people's reasons. The tenor of Lincoln's address especially hurt. The tone of frankness and benevolence, which he assumes in his speech to the colored committee, is too thin a mask not to be seen through. The genuine spark of humanity is missing in it. It expresses merely the desire to get rid of them, blacks, and reminds one of the politeness with which a man might try to bow out of his house some troublesome creditor or the witness of some old guilt. An embittered Douglas laid bare the fullest meaning in colonization schemes. Blacks generally exploded with ire at Lincoln's colonization address. Protest meetings were held across the North. In language rich with patriotism and resolve, a Queens County, New York gathering lectured Lincoln, "This is our native country. We have as strong attachment naturally to our native hills, valleys, plains, luxuriant forests, mighty rivers, and lofty mountains as any other people." An African-American group in Philadelphia pointed to its social progress as evidence that white supremacy could be thwarted. "Shall we sacrifice this, leave our homes, forsake our birthplace, and flee to a strange land?" they asked. "To appease the prejudice of the traitors now in arms against the government?" An A.P. Smith of New Jersey replied to Lincoln by writing to Douglas's paper, "Even if racism was impregnable, as the president believed, must I crush out my cherished hopes and aspirations, abandon my home, and become a pauper to the mean and selfish spirit that oppresses me?" A white radical abolitionist, Beriah Green, accused Lincoln of braying, babbling, enough to turn the stomach of an ostrich. The debate over colonization always came back, as in these testimonies, to its root: the American struggle over white supremacy. Some blacks, although a diminishing minority, responded favorably to the Lincoln administration colonization proposals. By October 1862, Kansas Senator Samuel Pomeroy, the administration's chief promoter of colonization schemes, claimed he had received 13,700 applications from potential black emigrants, two of whom were Douglas's frustrated sons, Lewis and Charles, who, now as young adults, broke with their father's wishes and decided to consider moving to Panama. 2 months earlier, Pomeroy had issued a widely published call, "The Appeal to Free Colored People of the United States," describing the advantages and noble purposes of the Central American scheme. Lewis Douglas was just shy of 22 years old, and Charles of 18. Douglas had written to Pomeroy a letter of introduction for at least one son, likely Lewis, whom Douglas described as of age, forms his own opinions, pursues his own plans, and agrees with me and differs from me in the exercise of that liberty as American young men generally, who have their own way to make in the world. We can know little about the intensity of these father-son disagreements, or of the surges of youthful independence of black males with limited options living at home in Rochester. Within half a year, those prospects, however, markedly changed. The Central American initiative crumbled nearly as fast as it emerged in the face of its proprietor's corruption and new historical imperatives. The president's intentions with colonization have long been the subject of rigorous debate in Lincoln scholarship. One recent biographer has called his August 14th White House meeting the puzzling low point in Lincoln's race relations, while another has analyzed it as part of the president's larger strategic racism. Yet another writer has oddly complimented Lincoln for his remarkable racial candor and stressed that his brand of colonization only asked for volunteers, as opposed to the expulsion of blacks advocated by the harsher members of the administration. Still another biographer, while thoroughly quoting the most racially insensitive lines of Lincoln's address, concludes that it should be seen as the chief executive trotting out colonization to smooth the way for emancipation. Some Lincoln scholars have long chosen to believe that the president was never truly serious about colonization and used it as a trial balloon to condition public opinion for his larger rendezvous with history, the Emancipation Proclamation. Over time, many have chosen to see their Lincoln as morally whole from 1865 rather than back in the volatile, revolutionary moments of 1861 to 62. Still other scholars have forcefully argued that Lincoln was a true believer in colonization and never relinquished it as a policy option until he had to. As Eric Foner has written, there is no reason to doubt the sincerity of Lincoln's 10 years of public support for colonization. It had always been one part of a larger vision of how slavery might end. To Douglas, Lincoln's colonization appeal on August 14th was not merely a personal insult to his or any African American's integrity. It was a denigration of humane values, a vile dashing of newfound hope. To these colored people, said Douglas, without power and without influence, the president is direct, undisguised, and unhesitating. He says to the colored people, I don't like you. You must clear out of the country. Racism is sometimes a political maneuver, a strategic position in the face of vicious opposition, a habit of mind entailed upon one's soul, or a structural or institutional force beyond the grasp of individuals. But sometimes it must be comprehended, indeed felt first, in the heart of the insulted. Candor is ultimately judged by its recipient. In September 1862, Douglas launched a counterattack, insisting that Negro-hating mobs and colonization agents were united by what he called the satanic spirit of colonization. He sought to refute the racial determinism at the heart of colonizationism and took dead aim at its central assumptions, that white prejudice was unconquerable, that blacks naturally gravitated toward tropical climates, that color was a natural barrier to interracial marriage, that race fixed physical and intellectual aptitude, and that the character of blacks and whites required social separation. United by these lethal theories, mobs provided the brickbats and pistols, Douglas said, while colonizationists furnished the arguments and piety. Douglas felt driven to resist what he called a miserable philosophy, to claims about the black man's nature inclining him to servility. Douglas charged that it was color and not his nature that so troubled the proponents of removal. He reaffirmed his belief in a common human nature of all men, and called racial prejudice just another proof of man's perverse proclivity to create the causes of his own misery. Douglas all but enjoyed dismissing the absurdity of climatic racial theory by suggesting that if colonizationists considered climatic distribution of the races their mission, he would demand that Caucasians, who had emigrated to every continent on Earth, be sent back to Europe. To the belief that a ban of nature prevented intermarriage between the races, he simply pointed to the large mulatto population in America, and therefore to himself. Douglas's modern and absurdist critique of the racism at the heart of colonization schemes seems driven by both outrage and amusement. It came through a brilliant critique of racist psychology. To him, the fear of miscegenation always reflected a larger purpose. Whenever any new villainy is to be perpetrated, or any old one against the Negro perpetuated, the popular prejudice is rallied by a denunciation of amalgamation. Ridicule was his only alternative. Douglass cast the denial of racial equality in global terms. If men may not live peaceably together in the same land, they cannot so live on the same continent and ultimately in the same world. If heterogeneity could not work in America, where could it? If the black man cannot find peace from the aggressions of the white race on this continent, he reasoned, he will not be likely to find it permanently on any part of the habitable globe. Douglass never wavered, as he had said as early as his famous address on ethnology in 1854, from the cardinal belief in the instinctive consciousness of the common brotherhood of man. In the fall of 1862, through Postmaster General Montgomery Blair, the Lincoln administration tried to officially enlist Douglass to help lead their colonization schemes. Responding to Douglass's letter of protest to Senator Pomeroy, which does not survive, Blair sought to assure Douglass that there was no question of superiority or inferiority involved in the proposed removal. Blair invoked the reputation of Thomas Jefferson to underscore the necessity of racial separation. The minority race, argued Blair, must go elsewhere to imitate the civilization established by the majority race, thinking as white men, as Lincoln put it. The propriety of colonization stemmed from the differences between them, and it seems as obvious to me as it was to the mind of Jefferson that the opinion against which you protest is the necessary result of indelible differences thus made by the Almighty. Here it was again. Colonization theory, gilded by the image of Jefferson, determined by God, driven by white supremacy while claiming otherwise, and callously argued by a member of Lincoln's cabinet. No ancient Exodus story or impulse for the natural right of emigration motivated Blair's appeal to racism. In Douglass's public reply, one of the most extraordinary letters in American history from a black leader to a high-ranking government official about race, Douglass thanked Blair for the opportunity to assess the colonization issue. Then, writing on September 16th, on a day between the surrender of huge numbers of Union troops to Confederate General Stonewall Jackson at Harper's Ferry on the 15th, and the Battle of Antietam in Maryland on the 17th, the bloodiest day in American history, Douglass lambasted Blair's theory and purpose. As evidence to refute climatic theory, Douglass pointed to nearly 250 years of black residence on American soil. If ever any people can be acclimatized, I think the Negro can claim to be so in this country. Perhaps Douglass was wryly smiling about all the winters he had spent in the snow belt of Rochester, New York. The idea of racial climate zones had gained wide acceptance in antebellum America, especially due to the work of the Harvard biologist Louis Agassiz, who had applied the notion of zoological provinces for animal and plant life to the races of man. Douglass refused to see scientific racial theory as anything but ideology. He considered all discussion of confining different varieties of men to different belts of the Earth's surface to be chimerical in the extreme. Refusing any longer to be lectured to, Douglass did the lecturing. He bluntly rejected Blair's white nationalism, insisting that blacks and whites could live under the same government. "We have readily adapted ourselves to your civilization," he continued. "We are Americans by birth and education, and have a preference for American institutions as against those of any other country." In direct language that might apply to any xenophobic panic or racial exclusion impulse down through American history, Douglass put Blair on notice. "That we should wish to remain here is natural to us and creditable to you." Douglass and the Republicans came to a similar view of the future of slavery in America. But on the future racial character of an American nation, they were as yet far apart. As a final objection to Blair's entreaty, Douglass once again addressed the pernicious effects of colonization, which he saw as pro-slavery theory in disguise. Douglass insisted that slavery, racism, and future black equality be discussed as a single question, to be settled on American soil, within American institutions. Douglass ended his letter to Blair with an appeal for national regeneration born of the cruel war, declaring confidently that out of this terrible baptism of blood and fire through which our nation is passing, not as has been most cruelly affirmed, because of the presence of men of color in the land, but by malignant vices nursed into power at the poisoned breast of slavery. It will come at last, purified in its spirit, freed from slavery, vastly greater than it ever was before in all the elements of advancing civilization. The angry orator's demolition of Blair is one for the ages, and one of the great documents of his writing life. Douglass's best answer to this personal challenge from colonizationists was to assert his people's claim to American nationality. For 40 years, African Americans had faced colonization as both threat and opportunity. But in 1862, the debate took place in an urgent wartime atmosphere. In the midst of the war, with emancipation on the horizon, Douglass led this struggle against a last hurrah of colonization. As Douglass parried with Blair over the consequences of freeing black people, President Lincoln was preoccupied with whether, when, and how to do it. On September 15, 1862, President Lincoln received dispatches from General McClellan about his somewhat exaggerated sense of victory that day at South Mountain and Crampton's Gap in Maryland. As Robert E. Lee's army reorganized along Antietam Creek, Lincoln wrote back a quick message. God bless you, and all with you. Destroy the rebel army if possible. Just 2 days earlier at the White House, Lincoln had met with a delegation of clergy from Chicago who delivered to him a direct appeal for a proclamation by the president of general emancipation of the slaves. They believed that such a decree was God's divine will, and that marvelous conversions to the wisdom of emancipation had recently swept across the North. Lincoln engaged the ministers in an open exchange over the timing and consequences of an emancipation edict. He had abandoned constitutional qualms about freeing slaves as commander-in-chief. He viewed it, he said, as a practical war measure. In these tense weeks, Lincoln seemed almost at war with himself about just what to do about slavery. He seemed worried about his actual power on the ground. How could he stop, for example, rebel troops from kidnapping blacks from Maryland back to Virginia and selling them into slavery, when the Union Army could not seem to stop Lee's invasion? How could his word free slaves, when he admitted, I cannot even enforce the Constitution in the rebel states? Lincoln feared doing only what would appear as inoperative. A proclamation might only be like the Pope's bull against the comet, the president half-joked. After this parley about ending slavery, Lincoln assured the ministers that the subject is on my mind by day and night more than any other. Lincoln had prepared a draft of his preliminary emancipation proclamation at least as early as July 22, 1862, when he announced to a cabinet meeting his intention to issue such a document. Timing, in the end, was all. In the wake of the Battle of Antietam and Lee's retreat across the Potomac River into Virginia, the president had victory enough on the battlefield so as not to worry that emancipation by executive order would be ineffective. Likely on Sunday, September 21st, Lincoln redrafted in hand his proclamation. The document put the South and the world on notice that on January 1st, 1863, unless the Confederacy ceased the war, Lincoln would free all the slaves in the states in rebellion. Again, he urged gradualism as well as colonization of freed blacks by their consent on this continent or elsewhere. Demonstrating his haste to get the document before his cabinet and proclaimed on September 22nd, the president used scissors to cut out sections of both Congress's Article of War from March, ordering the Army and the Navy to receive all fugitive slaves into their lines, and the Second Confiscation Act of July 17th, reinforcing even more forcefully the same principle. He then pasted these sections into his original draft. In the document's third paragraph, in language never to be forgotten in American civil religion, and which Douglass seized upon with renewed hope, Lincoln said that all persons held as slaves in the designated states and regions as of January 1st shall be then, thenceforward, and forever, free. All members of the armed forces of the United States were commanded to do no act or acts impeding the freed people from exercising their actual freedom. In Lincoln's cabinet, Douglas's colonization nemesis, Montgomery Blair, was the sole member to oppose the preliminary proclamation. Response in the border states was general.